Hey everybody, what's up? Welcome to Nowhere to Run or Bible Prophecy Talk, depending on which podcast feed you are listening to this. It has been a while since the last podcast, so I thought I would use this episode to catch you all up on what I've been doing over the past year and what my plans are for the future, which does include podcasting more regularly. At least that's the plan, and I'll talk about what that plan looks like as we progress. But I also thought I would use this opportunity to go over some of the highlights that have happened over the year and maybe just hit some things that I'm particularly interested in. First, let's hit some basic show notes on what I've been doing, etc. For the bulk of my free time over the past year or a few months anyway, I've been researching and writing a book. And I'll be a little mysterious here because I am not going to announce what that book is about. And I wrote it under a pseudonym, so it's sort of a secret book, but it's just because the person I wrote it for listens to this podcast and it would be seen by them as me kind of calling them out for this particular issue. And I don't want any of that. I didn't even want to write the book, quite frankly, but it's an issue that's very controversial. And so I know I'm probably making you want to read it even more now, but I'm not going to announce it. But that is what I've been doing with most of my time the last year. In addition to that, the Once Saved, Always Saved documentary, it's been doing good. It has over 200,000 views on YouTube, 2.5 million views on Facebook. I will link in the description the film, Once Saved, Always Saved, a documentary film, as well as encourage you to subscribe to one or both of those channels on YouTube or Facebook, because the project that I'll announce later, which is sort of a new video episode-based project that will be many, many hours long, is going to be probably released on those channels. So I'm going to use that Once Saved, Always Saved documentary film as the platform to release a lot of the new material. So you'll want to subscribe to that on YouTube and Facebook, as well as to these two podcast feeds. Speaking of the podcast feeds, I'm going to really segregate the Bible Prophecy Talk and Nowhere to Run feeds. If you're more interested in the Bible Prophecy stuff, you'll want to subscribe to the Bible Prophecy Talk feed because that's just going to be exclusive to Bible Prophecy stuff. And I'm going to release a lot of new material there, or at least material that has not been released in podcast form before, audiobooks and this kind of stuff that I've done in the past. But I can mostly just keep that going, have regular episodes scheduled for that. So it's going to be a good place to be subscribed if you're interested in that in 2025. The Nowhere to Run feed is going to be focused more on my, theology stuff, which, you know, I'm assuming a lot of you are like just not cool with. But if that's sort of what you're interested in, and I'll talk about that a little bit later, I'm going to use that for exclusively those purposes there on the Nowhere to Run feed. I'm releasing this podcast on both feeds so that you can all be on notice to go ahead and get subscribed to the proper feed going forward. As far as spiritually speaking, this has been the best year that I can remember. As far as sanctification goes, I am, closing in on 2 years sober, 2 years free from pornography and lusting after women with my eyes. I talked about both of those issues in previous podcasts, more recently the pornography issue, and then also the sobriety with alcohol issue in the backsliding episode about Once Saved, Always Saved, which has been quite a ways back now. But both of those issues seem like ancient history now. It seems like it's almost impossible that I could ever be enslaved by those things again. And it feels different than the first time that that happened. My story is that when I was first saved many years ago, and the Spirit really changed my outlook on everything. For that first 2 years, I was almost like on spirit autopilot, in which I was giving up sins and temptations and stuff. I didn't know any theology, but I knew that I wanted to live a holy life. And during that time, I also had victory and freedom over alcohol and pornography and things that enslaved me. However, in that case, once I finally learned, modern theology, which, say what you want, it does say that you can, you shall not surely die, basically, is sort of the core message of modern theology, that you can have your sin back and that there are no major consequences other than maybe loss of rewards, as long as you'd had the initial spirit experience, in which I totally had. And so, yeah, I started to dabble, and eventually that led to slavery again. And it led to essentially a binge and purge cycle, which I'm firmly convinced the modern Christianity believes is sanctification. You know, they can lie to themselves and say, you know, if you've had that new creature in Christ experience, which, you know, people that genuinely have had that experience can say, yes, I've had that, then say, okay, well, then you're good. And so they can say that that binge and purge, complete slavery to sin process is sanctification, which is just completely different than what I'm experiencing now, which is almost identical in some ways to that first experience of freedom after repentance. But the difference is this time is that I have burned the bridge. I genuinely have fear of God, which keeps me from, you know, dabbling on a bad day or a good day or a really nice sunset or, you know, some kind of thing to go back into drinking alcohol or something like that. That's just not an option for me anymore. And because I've completely cut that off as a just non-starter, it's just not going to happen. I'm not going to do it. And as a result, over the last year or two, it's gotten even more distant. Any kind of desire for those things are just so much further away than they were a year before. And, you know, I'm dealing with other things. You know, I'm called to be obedient in things that, you know, I wouldn't even have called sins before. And now I'm sort of working on that. And, you know, it's taking me a while to relinquish certain things like that. But it's always still joy and freedom when I do. Similarly, things that I think are perennial things that all humans have to battle, such as, you know, temptation to anger, temptation to unforgiveness, or, you know, the need to be humble, the need to be using your gifts and being fruitful. All those things are, you know, high level sanctification stuff that does get easier, but it's also always challenging. No matter what level you are on humility or what level you are on dealing with anger, you can both see it get better, extremely better than, say, the year before, but at the same time, be at a new level of difficulty. It's a hard thing to express. And that's, I think, the confusion that people say when you say, you know, we're called to be obedient and to live by his commandments. And they say, are you saying that we're sin-free? And you say, no, we're not sin-free, but I'm not doing the things that he said would send me to hell anymore. And I'm free from the bondage of that. Briefly, I wanted to talk about the search for a church over the last year because it was a little more difficult than I was thinking it would be. In the documentary, Once Saved, Always Saved, to talk about how originally in America, the denominations, sort of the main denominations, mostly did not believe in Once Saved, Always Saved. It was traditionally only the Presbyterians, i.e. the Calvinists, and the Baptists that, you know, were the ones that believed in Once Saved, Always Saved. Everybody else, the vast majority of those denominations, did not believe it. But over the last, I want to say, 20 or 30 years, with the rise of non-denominational churches and megachurches, which are sort of interconnected in a way, that's all changed. And I call them one-point Calvinists, because the non-denominational and megachurches must have the Once Saved, Always Saved. They'll reject pretty much, generally speaking, the other points of Calvinism, but that last point, the only point that matters, they will keep. And whether these church administrators know it overtly or not, at some level, everybody knows that you cannot fill a megachurch without having Once Saved, Always Saved. And when a megachurch does so well and makes so much money, that's what gets copy and pasted in the model of non-denominational churches. So it's the rise of the megachurch that gets copied with the smaller one, you know, non-denominational churches. And so one-point Calvinism has basically taken over. So there really almost is a dying amount of churches that even are considered denominational. But in my church journey, I found that even those denominations that on paper are staunchly against historically Once Saved, Always Saved, they're changing. They're doing everything that they can. They recognize that to survive, they have to have Once Saved, Always Saved. For example, I went to a Pentecostal sort of denominational church. I think it was a Church of God. And, you know, on paper, they are totally against Once Saved, Always Saved. And it was different than, you know, what I'm used to in Once Saved, Always Saved churches. You know, whenever they read a passage that's like, you know, clearly rebuking Once Saved, Always Saved, they've got to like, okay, everybody time out. Let's remind ourselves that we all believe that everything we do is fine and we don't have anything to worry about. And this passage may sound a little scary, but it doesn't mean what it means. You got to have the little Once Saved, Always Saved time out. And that's what I'm used to hearing. But it was interesting on the Pentecostal side, the timeout was different. He wanted to he knew that on paper, they were not supposed to believe once saved, always saved. But his timeout was that he really wanted to believe once saved, always saved. And for all intents and purposes, that church did believe in once saved, always saved. He basically preached 180 degrees from their mission statement or belief statement, of, according to that denomination. And, you know, that was sort of a budding mega churchy sort of thing. It was starting to, you know, get popular. And I don't know if it's that they know it's about money or they just want it for themselves, because it's almost impossible to resist that idea that they're, you know, that there's nothing that you need to do. As long as you've had that initial experience, you're fine. You can have your favorite sin and Jesus at the same time. You don't really have to be obedient or die to yourself or do anything other than be about 10 to 15% better than the world. But that same experience happened over and over. There was another somewhat mega church that on paper has a Wesleyan background, definitely does not believe in once saved, always saved. But I was listening to their sermons online and I was like, you know, he's not really hitting any of those issues. And he's just, you know, feel good kind of sermons. So I emailed him and I said, you know, I just wanted to check to see where your stance is on once saved, always saved. I know your background is Wesleyan and everything, but what's your stance? And his email was just totally completely once saved, always saved. So like, yeah, I know that that's what it says, but we totally believe once saved, always saved in this church. And, you know, gave me his spiel, basically. Some of the other denominations had their own problems. The modern Methodist Church, the United Methodist Church, has become extremely liberal, almost unrecognizable. They have split now. The Global Methodist Church is the sort of conservative version of that. I didn't really look into that much. There were some here locally, but they had their own problems. And that's another thing. Sometimes they can be okay on one issue, but radically wrong on other issues. So, for example, eschatology and issues related to the spirit, both of which I'm generally okay to nuance about, except for a lot of the, you know, like the Church of Christ, their view on eschatology, and to a certain extent, a lot of Methodists as well, is that they're amillennial. They don't even believe that there will be an end times, which is just a sort of a deal breaker. You can be, modern sort of premillennial and pre-trib rapture. I'm okay. You know, as long as you don't make it a huge thing and it's not something that you preach on every week because it's like a huge issue with you, that would be a deal breaker. But as long as you're premillennial, fine. But again, with the spirit, you know, there's lots of nuance there and different gradients of that, but you just can't be cessationist. You know, there is no spirit. That's sort of the deal breaker there. And so you've got these kind of issues happening with other denominations. I ended up focusing on one in particular that I think is a good mix, although it's going to change depending on church by church, which is the Nazarene Church. They sort of broke off from the Methodist Church very early on. It's sort of a conglomeration of those that were focused on holiness as an important part of Christianity. They used to be very conservative, no makeup and that kind of stuff, but that has softened a little bit. They've got their own issues, but so far right now, they seem to be at least holding the line a little bit with the sort of original version of salvation. But it's happening. I mean, it's every day chipping away at that kind of thing. I will mention Zach Poonen's church. If you could find one of those CFC churches, I would love to go to one of those. That sounds like a pretty good deal. And I'm sure there's scattered all over the world, great churches that may call themselves non-denominational. And maybe you know of some that are really good in that regard, but it's getting hard. It's getting very difficult. But I do think it's important to go to church. I think it's important to try to find them and to pray about it and to listen to their sermons online and see what you can find out there, because it's important. Even if it is a small church, 30, 40 people showing up on Sunday, that has its own benefits. And if it's a good person, my main thing was this. I wanted a pastor who took his job as a shepherd seriously. This is in some ways my only concern. And I think once saved, always saved was just an issue that led to this issue being real or not. The pastor needed to believe that his job was to shepherd these people in the pews, and that their blood was more or less on his hands, and that he wasn't so flippant that he's going to have a sermon about nothing that has nothing to do with anything, because he's not scared for their souls. He thinks that they're fine. They're ready to go anyway. He doesn't really care about where they're going, because as far as he's concerned, they're all going to heaven. But that's not what a shepherd used to be. And it's not what I want. I want a person also that seems like he knows the way, you know, that I can look at him and say, that guy is following the way. And I want to learn from him about how he got there and what it takes to endure to the end and be faithful and endure all the trials that happen in life and to do so faithfully. That's what I want to learn from somebody. And if you don't have any fear of God and you don't really believe that anybody's lives are at risk, their souls are at risk, then you're just going to basically turn into a job in which you write a cute little sermon that you can pat yourself on the back and tell yourself you're going to get a lot of rewards in heaven for. But in fact, the Bible says that you should not desire to be a teacher because you're going to get a much more severe judgment. And that doesn't mean a loss of rewards. So I said I was going to go over some topics that I missed over the past year. Obviously, geopolitics and politics has been a big deal, but quite frankly, I'll probably disappoint you guys all because I don't have a lot of takes on this. I've really checked out a lot from politics and stuff. I do like Robert Kennedy Jr. Obviously, if you're a longtime listener of this podcast, you know that's the kind of stuff that I've been talking about for, I don't know, 20 years plus. And I'm sure that's the case with a lot of you too. And I certainly experienced this over the Christmas holidays, you know, and I've gotten sort of wind of it, especially since the election and Robert Kennedy Jr. sort of being mainstream. It seems like it's finally okay to talk about all this stuff. And, you know, you get pat on the back from people like, you were always telling me about fluoride and you were always telling me about this thing or that thing. And it looks like you're validated. Maybe that's not been your experience, but it's almost like, you know, we all knew that from the beginning. It's like, yeah, I don't think so. I don't think so. But it is good to have some validation. Although, you know, with the vaccine stuff, I see evidence that that is, you know, finally being talked about. I really do have high hopes. And quite frankly, I can't imagine if there is a strong they presence out there in the deep state or whatever. I mean, how are they going to let Robert Kennedy Jr. in there? I mean, he seems like he's really going to change a lot of this regulatory capture of big pharma and big food on the government. I mean, we need that so desperately. I mean, if you lived through COVID, you know that it got pretty insane. And that's just one issue, the vaccines issue. And it caused, I mean, untold damage. But I think I said back in the day when we were talking about you know, the vaccine a lot and, you know, trying to warn people against it. And, you know, it was obvious that one day all of this would come out. And I think there was like a desire, certainly from everybody to be like, you know, one day you'll all get vindicated and proven right. And there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth about the wrongs that they did. And I remember saying that I have no doubt that the truth will come out about all of this, but when it does, no one will care. Like, you'll never get the vindication that you really wanted from that. Yes, they'll admit it. They'll probably say they believed it the whole time or just won't care. It won't be a topic of conversation. But my point is that, man, the vaccine issue, all the vaccines that we're giving the kids without placebo-controlled trial. By the way, I want to explain that because if I find that people don't really understand what he means by that. Robert Kennedy Jr. is saying that none of the childhood vaccines that we give the kids, and I don't know how many it is these days, I don't know, a kajillion, have had a single placebo-controlled trial on it. Never. None of them. And what he means by that, and some of the backlash is saying, yes, they've had plenty of trials. Look at this paper here and this paper here. But what he's saying is a placebo-controlled trial. So this is how they get away with this travesty. They give a group of kids over here on the left, they give them the vaccine in question, the one they're trying to get approved. And then they got another group over here, and in a placebo trial, you give them a saline or a placebo, something that is completely inert, that cannot harm them. And then you determine, okay, is the group over here more likely to get autism or other problems than this group over here? But they've never done that. And that's what you do with drugs. All the other drugs have that happen, but not these childhood vaccines that we give our kids. So what do they do instead? Instead of giving them a saline solution or an inert substance, they give them another vaccine, not the same vaccine that they're testing over here, the new one, but like an old one that they have already approved. and which has the same problematic ingredients or the same problematic adjuvants as the other one that they're testing. And so when inevitably the kids have the same rates of autism, the same rates of adverse effects on both groups, they're able to say with a straight face in court or whatever that, you know, there was no statistical difference between the rates of autism in the group and the other group. And so that's how they get away with saying what they've been saying for the last few years. And everybody knows that you can't get any of these vaccines passed while actually doing a placebo-controlled trial because it's just such a dangerous thing to give kids. You know, and SIDS deaths are the same thing. You can't find any SIDS or very few SIDS deaths. Let's say it like this. If you saw a chart versus of, you know, sudden infant death syndrome and kids that have just come back from their wellness check where they get a vaccine, it's transparent what's happening. And so that's the kind of stuff that I'm like, I mean, we could get into the seed oils and the other stuff too, and the fluoride in the water and the, you know, the food that's killing us, et cetera. But that's sort of my main thing that I feel like that's the victory that I'm interested in. With regard to geopolitics and war, I think that it's, you know, I feel a little bit like you can take a breath of fresh air, but I'm not sure if that's genuine or not. In many ways, I think that all the same reasons to go to war exist. I know that this interim period, there really is a push to provoke Russia into escalation. I don't think that stops. I think that the lines are being drawn that they're bigger than politics in America. And it has a lot more to do with economics and demographics, that is to say the declining populations, as well as economic problems, than it does with whatever America does or doesn't do or peace deals or those kinds of things. And I think that all those trends and forces do lead to a much more likely scenario of war. And you have America at the sort of end stage empire where the dollar is becoming, you know, not the currency that's being used for settling trade deals across the world and stuff. I mean, America is not going to let that go. I mean, that's been our bread and butter. That's why we exist, is the U.S. Treasury and the U.S. dollar being the lingua franca of the world. To take that away is to take America away. And that's exactly what's happening right now. So that's got to come to a head. As you know, I believe that a recession is always been inevitable. I've called 8 of the last 2 recessions. But I do think that the economic situation is not good, and it never has been good. They're basically extending and pretending and lying throughout the Biden administration. Backwards revisions of the, you know, they come out with a jobs number and they celebrate it as being a good number. And then the next month they revise it down. It's like, oh, by the way, last month we were totally wrong about that. It's actually terrible, but that doesn't make the headlines. And they've been doing that for a year straight. Everybody knows that the inflation is bad and the economy is not good, but with Trump in office, I believe that they'll finally pull the rug under that. It's inevitable anyway. But when America catches a cold, the rest of the world gets the plague, or however that saying goes. Economically speaking, we are a significant driver of economics. And so if we're dealing with a severe recession, you're going to have starvation and so on in the third world. And, you know, in Europe and other places, it's going to be really bad as well. And bad economics means a push for more socialism, more communism, which causes more political strife. And that political strife takes a lot of different shapes and forms across the world. And then, as I mentioned, the demographic issue, a lot of countries like China recognize that they're in a position where they need more people or they can't survive. And they need a lot of things. Just, you know, countries are having existential threats. Russia is seemingly being threatened with its very existence every single day. And when you push countries and people into corners like that, where it's like either all or nothing, you just never know which way it's going to go. And that brings me to the subject of Bible prophecy. So I thought I would give a update about where I think we are in the Bible prophecy timeline, if anywhere, and just some general thoughts about what's been going on in Israel and those kinds of things. So I'm going to assume that many of you know my stance on Bible prophecy, namely that I don't believe that the rapture will happen until after the midpoint of the 70th week, sometimes called pre-wrath rapture. Also that I believe that the 10 kings mentioned in Daniel 7, and in fact, many times in Revelation, they must exist as a cohesive group before the Antichrist arrives, as per Daniel 7, particularly, but also inferred in other places. And as a result of those two things, you can say that we need the 10 kings to show up and rule in some cohesive way. I believe they'll be around the Mediterranean as a pet theory. I also believe that they will control Israel as a state, which is something that's on nobody's radar before the Antichrist arrives, that the Antichrist will arrive as a liberator of Israel and will seem to be fulfilling all the prophecies of the Messiah to Israel, freeing them from the clutches of the 10 kings. The Antichrist shows up in opposition to the 10 kings, destroys three of them, eventually takes it all over as a part of his theocracy that begins at the midpoint. Now, if that's the scenario, then we are just not there. I mean, we need a lot of geopolitical stuff to happen, including what appears to be a complete negation of the West. And really, that's just not going to happen unless some kind of major shift happens. It's just not on anybody's radar. You know, America has got to not be a force anymore. Consolidation of power probably around the Mediterranean, although I'm open to the 10 kings being more of a global situation. But yeah, if they come first and the Antichrist's first act is opposition to three of those 10 kings, then we're certainly nowhere near the 70th week of Daniel because, you know, you've got precursors then before the 70th week of Daniel can happen. Now, as you know, Israel's in the news, Iran's in the news, Russia's in the news, which is just how Lindsay triggering for every, you know, the modern version of pre-trib mindset. So every other Bible prophecy situation is going to be talking about the nuance of like what the troop movements are and how much Iran and Russia did and all these things. And I'm not blind to it. What I'm mostly concerned about with that stuff is that Satan would, I mean, I've often said in lots of my books and stuff that that's the point of Gog, that the Jews are currently waiting on God, what they call Gog Magog. To the Jews, that's their book of Revelation, right? Gog Magog is what they're waiting to happen for the revelation of the Messiah. And so if you're going to pretend to be the Messiah, you need a Gog Magog war, a fake one. And so I believe that that's what we're likely to see happen at some point. Although, to be quite frank, I don't see how that benefits Satan until after Israel's already taken over, loses its sovereignty. And that's a huge deal because most Bible prophecy people would say that they believe that the restoration of Israel in 1948 or 67 was the biblical, you know, dry bones prophecy. And if that's true, which I don't believe is true, I believe that that's referring to the regathering that happens after the day of the Lord and as a part of the thousand-year millennium prophecy and is talking about restored people who believe in their Messiah and things are good. That's not what has happened. And it's certainly not in context of the dry bones prophecy, which clearly has to have the Messiah in their midst at that time. You don't get one without the other. It's not like a chronological thing. I go through that in the, I think the Gog Magog series that I did. Anyways, I'm getting off the subject, but my point is I don't think that that even benefits Satan right now to pretend to do a Gog Magog war, even though Russia and Iran and are in the news. In fact, I can't imagine that. I think probably if I was to just take a wild guess at what happens, I think with the fall of Syria, I think that Israel will push to expand its borders a little bit. Same thing on the west side to Egypt. I believe that Israel currently, whether the leadership believes it or not, the people certainly are being led to believe that they're in a moment of like Gog Magog. So the Jewish people believe that Gog Magog is, you know, it's their end times. We think of it as a part of our end times, but for them, it is the book of Revelation. And if you listen to like the Jewish influencers that particularly talk about the Messiah issues a lot, which is a brand new thing, by the way, it didn't used to exist, but now there are these sort of Jewish influencers that talk about the end times and talk about their perspective about what to expect with the Messiah and stuff. And I mean, they believe that they're in it. They believe that they're in the end times since the thing about a year ago with the Palestinians sort of incursion, and that they've basically been in stages of the end times, and that they need to do all the stuff that they need to do in order for the Messiah to come. So they believe that they are in sort of a moment of the end times right now. And of course, one of the big prophecies is they were supposed to expand their borders to what's called Greater Israel, which is supposed to be to the all the way to the Euphrates and Syria and whatnot to the east, and all the way to the Nile on the west. And depending on which influencer and sort of view of Judaism you're talking to, they believe they have to do that before the Messiah will come. And of course, they believe that they're going to rebuild a temple, and that basically the world, they will be the capital city of the world again. I mean, that's the promise of the millennium, basically, is the way I see it. But they see it as, you know, not the millennium, because they don't have the New Testament. But in any case, I think that a fake Gog-Magog war is how this all gets done. But I don't think it's going to happen now. I mean, you could have Russia and Iran in the news. And I think that the primary purpose of all that, in terms of from Satan's perspective, is kind of like it was for the last 100 years with evangelical Christianity, is that you sort of need his big trick in the end is a fake Gog-Magog war. Because if you get the timing of the Gog-Magog war wrong, you will get the wrong Messiah. You're going to be worshiping the wrong dude if you get your Gog-Magog theology wrong. And that is, so let me walk that through for you. Both Christians and Jews are waiting for a Gog-Magog war. They believe that when that happens, that winner of that is their Messiah and God. And so all you got to do is have yourself a convincing Gog-Magog war, and you get to be the worshiped God. So while I think that Russia, and I don't think Russia is Gog anyway, I think that's totally a Hal Lindsey thing. He got it from another guy. I talk about that in the thing as well. But Gog is the northern cohort of the Japhathian group. Basically, it's sort of eastern Turkey is Gog and Magog. There are literally places called Gog Magog. It's where all the Japheth sons, which are named Gomer and Togarmath and all this stuff, they're in Turkey. They never were in Russia. That was a whole, if you look at why that even happened, it's almost like, man, fool me once kind of thing. It only worked in the Cold War because everybody needed it to be Russia, because they were all, you know, whatever. But my point is, Satan doesn't care. And he is doing that right now to the Jewish people too. He's convincing them in the same way he's done for us the last 100 years, that it's Russia and it's Iran and those are your big bad enemies. And because he can control that. He can make that happen. He can give them a fake Gog-Magog war. He can't give them one like Ezekiel 38 and 39, like by the letter, certainly not, you know, Revelation 20 by the letter, but he can give them the one that he's been training them to expect for the last 100 years. And that's what he's going to deliver on. And I don't think he's going to deliver on it in the near term. My guess is that Israel's current expansion will either kind of fold into or cause the ultimate, the war that ends up resulting in the 10 kings and the control of Israel. So it's not until the Antichrist war against 3 of the 10 kings, as described in Daniel 7, that's the fake Gog-Magog war. I mean, if you want to look at where it happens, I think you could also look at Daniel 11, the latter half of Daniel 11. That is the fake Gog-Magog war. And it's interesting that currently Jewish people believe that the end of Daniel 11 is the Messiah, where every single Christian believes it's the Antichrist. That's like sort of drop the mic right there, is that war, what I call the wars of the Antichrist, Daniel 11, what is it, 36 through say 40, through the end of the chapter, that's the Antichrist. No Christian denies it. And yet those wars, which I believe are obviously faking the same wars in like Isaiah 11 of the actual Messiah, like it's intended to be a fake out. But the current view in Judaism is that that's a picture of the Messiah's wars. And just run that tape forward. What do you get when you have the guy doing the prophecy in Daniel 11, 36 through 45? You've got one group that should know better, know that it's the Antichrist, and the other group thinks it's the Messiah. But all those things, to wrap this all up, it just can't happen for a while, in my view. Okay, so let's move on to another topic, which is health stuff. If you are a listener of this podcast, you know I've always got a new health conspiracy to clue you in on. And the big one for me the last year has been the genetic mutation, sometimes known as MTHFR. And this is something I have devoted a huge amount of research to, and in some ways, I think it is almost the cause of most chronic diseases today. Because if you combine genetic mutations in the MTHFR part of your genome with the standard American diet, you get pretty much every modern disease. If you have a chronic disease right now, and you just type into PubMed MTHFR and the name of the thing that you're suffering with, and see if a published medical journal paper has linked MTHFR with your disease. Just do that. Pause this. MTHFR and whatever you're currently suffering with. And my guess is there's been a paper already written and more or less confirmed, at least a strong association with it. Now, this is a problematic in some ways because it's new. The mapping of the genome and the discovery of MTHFR are relatively new things. I can't remember exactly when the genome was mapped, but it's been relatively recently. In any case, this is not something that your general practitioner has had he didn't go to medical school for this. I mean, it wasn't even a part of his curriculum, partially because it was new. I think it will be a part of the curriculum later, as evidenced by the sheer amount of research and data that's coming out that's being done. Because as I said, I do think it is at least a major player in most of the chronic diseases that people have. So let me explain what it is. If you have MTHFR, it basically means that you have a genetic mutation, which is fairly common. It can be different gradients. It can be somewhat severe or it can be very severe, what they call homozygous MTHFR versus heterozygous MTHFR, which is a somewhat milder version. If you have the milder version, you are about 30 to 40% less good at what they call methylating folate. And if you have the severe version, you can be 70% or more sort of inhibited in your ability to methylate, to process folate. So what does that mean to process folate? So when you eat leafy greens, which is where we get the term foliage and folate, that's what it means. A lot of the folate that we eat is found in leafy greens, although there are other places that you can get it, but that's the primary place. When you eat leafy greens, your body turns them all, there's a little factory in your body that takes leafy greens and adds a little methyl group to them, and then it creates a little finished product called methylfolate. Methylfolate is like a raw material that is needed for a jillion processes in your body. So once you eat leafy greens, if your factory is working right, you produce methylfolate, and that methylfolate is needed for creating a ton of stuff. But mostly it has to do with B vitamins. A lot of the B vitamins like B12 or which is in its methylated form is methylcobalamin, as opposed to cyanocobalamin, which is in a lot of the supplements and stuff like that. So methylated B12, riboflavin, which I think is B2, all these B vitamins. Basically, if you have MTHFR, you are not good at all at making B vitamins that your body can use. And if you aren't good at making B vitamins, it can break down in lots of different ways. So it can basically produces a ton of inflammation because it produces something called homocysteine. Homocysteine may be the most important thing that your doctor is not putting on your blood test. If your doctor has actually put homocysteine on your blood test and you have that number, you have a good doctor. If your doctor has not put it on there, he's a bad doctor. It is probably the single most important metric you need to know as to whether or not you have this. I mean, you can get a genetic test for MTHFR. You can, do a cheek swab with saliva, send it into a lab. But you can also just go get a blood test for homocysteine. And if you have super high homocysteine, you're in danger. Like that Ralph Wiggum, I'm in danger meme. Because homocysteine alone, it's basically might as well be a proxy for how bad your MTHFR is. Homocysteine is basically means that something's breaking down in this process of creating methylfolate and all this other stuff. And it's super highly inflammatory. If you just typed in MTHFR into PubMed, the most thing that you would find is strokes, heart attacks, cancer. And the reason all those things are linked is because of homocysteine. Homocysteine just destroys the cellular wall of your circulatory system, sometimes called the endothelial system. And it goes in there and just destroys it. Homocysteine, incredibly inflammatory. So it causes all these scars, if you will, on your circulatory system. And what happens is those scars, they get patched over by a bunch of systems in your body trying to fix it. And what happens is it kind of catches calcium and catches other stuff, and it leads to blood clots. But in addition to leading to blood clots because of the inflammation caused by the homocysteine, which is caused by the MTHFR, which is caused by you not getting enough B vitamins, but that also leads to cancer, because cancer is almost directly related to how healthy your endothelial system is, how healthy that wall of your circulatory system is. Because we all have cancer viruses running through our blood, but it doesn't really hurt us in our bloodstream. You don't really hear people getting heart cancer. I don't know, maybe it exists, but I don't think so. What happens is when the cancer viruses get outside of your bloodstream and can get into your liver or can get into other parts of your body, that's when cancer of the XYZ happens. And that only happens if you have a porous or unhealthy endothelial system. So cancer and blood clots and heart attacks and artery blockages is so related to MTHFR. If you've said to yourself, you know, I've got a history of heart stuff in my family, we've got a, you know, it's in my family, heart stuff or strokes or whatever run deep, what you probably mean is that you have MTHFR. So the thing that, one of the reasons you probably won't, like, if you mention this to your doctor, if he's a good doctor, or you got a functional medicine doctor or something like that, which, by the way, Google functional medicine doctors near you, get on that train. It's definitely the way to go. They just do a bunch of tests and they see, go from there. They're data driven. They want to try to find the root causes of stuff. Functional medicine. Basically, the solution to this is the right kinds of B vitamins and diet. And because of that, because the solution is essentially easy and free, you will not hear about it from anything connected to Big Pharma. Big Pharma cannot make money off of fixing MTHFR in the same way that they can't make money off fixing diabetes. Let me talk about diabetes really quick. So I had, over the last year, I think I may have mentioned this, I had diabetes. I got a blood test when I went to my functional medicine doctor, and they, you know, lo and behold, did an A1C test, which for whatever reason is also not done typically with normal doctor blood tests. And that's basically if you have diabetes or not. And I had like a 9-point-something diabetes. So definitely full blown diabetes. Now, the official version of that is that that there's no cure for diabetes. You just got to get on insulin and whatever. But what they mean by no cure is that there is no pill that they can give you. But if you go on a, like I did for the next, whatever it was, 3 months, super low carb diet, eating well, you know, basically, insulin resistance is the name of the game. Look up insulin resistance. That was essentially the problem with diabetes. If you want to look at it really technically, it's visceral fat, the fat by your organs, not the subcutaneous fat, is almost directly related to the inflammation caused with diabetes and insulin resistance. There's a great book called not the Obesity Code, which is written by the same guy, but the Diabetes Code, if you're into all the details of diabetes. Even if you're currently on severe insulin stuff, check out the Diabetes Code. Really start looking at the success stories like me. So 3 months later, I went back. Not only do I not have diabetes again, I'm not even pre-diabetic. And so diet fixed diabetes for me. But it was also in that journey that I found out about MTHFR. So what happens, how do you fix MTHFR if you have it, and if you have it really bad? The bottom line is you've got to get methylated B vitamins. In some cases, especially if you're like me, there's another part of genetics called COMT, which is another genetic variation, which you can either have slow or fast COMT. What that basically means, if you have slow COMT, you're not. So this thing, MTHFR, is really connected to neurotransmitters and either anxiety or the need to go find a thrill, whether that's in drugs or alcohol or, you know, Red Bull jumping off of some building or something like that. So they call it the warrior or worrier gene. So warrior as in fighting person, you know, versus worrier as in biting their nails. And that what they basically mean by that is that one genetic variations sort of determines that aspect of you. And what it basically is your ability to process neurotransmitters like dopamine and epinephrine and norepinephrine and all this other stuff. Basically, you know, if you get in a normal anxiety situation, something that should normally spike anxiety, for a person like me who's pretty mild with my ability to process neurotransmitters, I'm not particularly high strung or have anxiety or whatever, I process it really quick. So if something happens where it makes me anxious, my factory that's supposed to break down neurotransmitters and it eliminate it in the urine, it works pretty well. And so for me, well, I'll get into how this relates to B vitamins in a minute, but let me discuss the other end of things. If somebody has a fast COMT, it means they process neurotransmitters almost too fast. And so whether it's, you know, that's the warrior gene, the fighter gene. So, it, you know, something comes in anxious or whatever, they process it, get rid of it really quick. So they're kind of always at a need for more dopamine. And so they're more likely to go get that sugar rush and get that endorphin rush, or always need to do something, you know, to keep that going. And actually ends up being this vicious cycle where it kind of makes like a binge and purge crash and feel bad and feel good. And you got to keep finding new hits to get it back up. But that whole process, in the same way, which is the other extreme, which is the warrior, the biting the nails, is that you're bad at processing neurotransmitters. It takes a long time to get the dopamine and norepinephrine and serotonin through the funnel to process it through your urine. So it kind of keeps stacking up. Now you've got more neurotransmitters stacking up and you're anxious because you're like basically full of neurotransmitters causing all kinds of problems. That's slow COMT. You're slow at processing them versus fast COMT. You're too fast at processing them. And that whole system, which is processing neurotransmitters, is related to MTHFR because if you're not producing methylfolate, methylfolate is needed for on down the line for a process to help you regulate that system, whether it's broken on the fast side or the slow side. But that's just one of the many things that it's messing with. But here's why I mentioned that is related to the fix of this. So the fix for me, who doesn't have a problem with the anxiety or anything else, is just taking a methylated B complex as well. And that is a B complex is basically a supplement that you can buy on Amazon. That's just a bunch of different B vitamins all in one pill. Typically you take like three of these pills a day, if not more. And I can handle, and methylfolate, you can supplement with methylfolate. I take, in addition to my B complex, I actually take B12, methylated B12 separately, additionally B12, as well as in some days I take additional methylfolate too. And those are all methylated B vitamins. And here's an important part of this, the methylated part. If you're taking a Centrum or a regular thing, you're not getting the right B vitamins. You're getting usually cyanocobalamin or folic acid as opposed to methylfolate. Let me talk about folic acid because this is what I mean by a combination of MTHFR and the standard American diet is killing us all. Look, folic acid is a big conspiracy. If folic acid is a synthetic B vitamin, it's not real. It was created in a lab. And the reason that they created it was because when they started making shelf-stable bread, I don't know, 100 years ago or something like that, started putting bread on the shelf, they wanted it to last longer. They had to process the bread in such a way to make it last longer. And the way that they processed it was basically by removing all the natural B vitamins that would be in the grain. But they immediately saw that they had a problem. They were causing birth defects and lots of other major problems with people not getting enough B vitamins because people were mostly eating a lot of bread. There wasn't supplements back then, so they were getting that stuff from bread and grains, even though it wasn't a great source of B vitamins. It was people's only source of B vitamins. And so when they made bread shelf stable, they people were extremely deficient. And so they added in America at least, added in B vitamins, this cyanocobalamin, they added folic acid into, is sort of a mandated thing in America. And so all the bread and shelf-stable crackers and that kind of stuff that you get at the grocery store has folic acid in it, a synthetic B vitamin that's there to help you not get birth defects and not to maintain you at a low level of not dying. But if you are like me, and I have a mildish version of MTHFR, I have compound heterozygous MTHFR. I have about a 30-40% reduction of it. If I take folic acid, the fake version of folate, methylfolate, it not only can I not use it at all, or very little, it actually clogs up the receptors that would normally be there to receive the good folate. So even if I was taking a good methylated B vitamin complex and eating a bunch of leafy greens, if I was also eating bread and other carbs that had folic acid in it, I would be even worse. I'm already genetically bad at processing folate, but if I'm eating folic acid, that's reduced it another huge amount because folic acid essentially clogs up my normal folate receptors. So all the folate that I would be getting from supplements or leafy greens, I can't process that either. So over time, this diet in combination with MTHFR causes us all to be just so deficient in all these things. And it's also deficient in other related minerals. So for example, magnesium is a critical component to all of this stuff. And we're not getting magnesium because we're not eating enough leafy greens. And even if we were eating enough leafy greens, the soil doesn't even have that much magnesium in it. So the even organic leafy greens these days don't have much magnesium in it. So you almost have to supplement magnesium regardless. And magnesium is a very important raw material for a lot of these processes. There is a book out there called Dirty Genes that I highly recommend, and I highly recommend getting in a YouTube rabbit hole for MTHFR. Also subscribe to the Reddit subreddit MTHFR if you want to learn more about this. But here's the thing I was going to finally say. For people who are high strung and have anxiety, for them, they need to be a little cautious when taking methylated B vitamins, because for them, if they get their neurotransmitter system working again and they're creating more neurotransmitters, but the process for breaking them down is still clogged up, methylated B vitamins can like completely solve all their problems for the first few days. They're like, oh my gosh, I no longer have headaches or inflammation. I'm, you know, brain fog is gone, all the stuff that gets fixed for a few days. And then they start to get headaches. They start to get a little bit even more anxious because they're the process for breaking down the neurotransmitters, it still needs work. For example, they probably still are deficient in magnesium, which is needed to help break those things down. So it's this holistic process. So I'll say it like this. The best thing that you can do is to eat correctly. And one of the things that you need to eat correctly, besides leafy greens, you just got to find a way to get a ton of leafy greens, spinach, and you know, Brussels sprouts and kale and whatever into your diet. A smoothie with stevia is an amazing way to do that. Use some yogurt and some kefir or something like that with some raw stevia. And I do 2 cups of greens per day with some other stuff. But with the stevia, it really helps. You don't even notice that it's greens. It's just wonderful. But in addition to that, liver, and of course, liver, I actually think that one of the reasons that we're all basically dying is because we no longer eat organ meats. The more you dive into this rabbit hole of MTHFR, you realize that a lot of this stuff, a lot of the B vitamins that we can use, they're in liver and other organ meats in addition to leafy greens. But that's sort of the main driver. It's like the superfood of it. And we just don't eat organ meats anymore. Now, I don't like liver, as I'm probably most of you are not going to have a nice plate of heart anytime soon, but liver, particularly beef liver, and ideally organic grass-fed beef liver, high quality beef liver, you can get in freeze-dried form in the form of pills. I mean, you got to take like 6 of them a day, but I think that one thing is just a game changer. If you need motivation for doing this, besides, if you have a chronic disease that you've done what I said earlier and you looked it up online and you said, oh my gosh, I have this. There's been like multiple papers saying that people that fix this issue and start getting methylfolate don't have this chronic disease anymore. Well, that's good motivation for you. But if you need more motivation, fixing your endothelial system fixes things like erectile dysfunction. It fixes things like we talked about the heart stuff. I mean, your risk, getting your homocysteine down basically dramatically increases your risk for dying of a heart attack or stroke or cancer. That's the basic only thing you need to know, that your cancer or heart disease risk of dying dramatically increases if you get your homocysteine down. By the way, you can go get your blood tested for, you don't need to interface with a doctor at all. Just do self-pay with, just look up blood tests near you. They've got these LabCorp or what do they call, I can't think of the name. They're basically in your town everywhere. You just call them up and say, hey, can I just come pay for a homocysteine test or, you know, whatever? And they'll say, yeah, come on in and get your A1C tested as well. A1C and homocysteine. Those are the things that the doctors won't test, but are unbelievably important to get tested, your diabetes score, A1C, and homocysteine. All right, finally, I wanted to talk about the project that I will be doing. And this is something that I feel like in some ways I've just been thinking about almost every day. I wake up thinking of different arguments to explain the nuance of all this stuff, what's gone wrong in Christianity, particularly, and this is nothing new. This is what the early church believed, really up until the Council of Nicaea. I mean, what we believe today would have been called heresy by the early church. The people that were trained by the apostles themselves, who are mentioned in the Bible, those people, if you explain to them what we currently believe, they'd be like, what do you mean, like Gnostic heresy? And yet, it's completely unquestioned these days. Take, for example, the idea of Jesus's teachings himself. You know, we all know that Jesus, his teachings seem kind of hard, but I don't think that we really understand how much we sweep them under the rug and how different that is from the early church, who believed that Jesus's teachings were Christianity. To say it another way, we don't believe that Jesus taught Christianity. We believe if you pressed people, they would say, oh yeah, well, some people would. Some people would say, no, Jesus taught the law or something like that. Or Jesus was just teaching us that we can't follow the law. He was just saying all these hard things so that you could know that there's nothing that you can do to follow the law, or some variation of that. But that is the heresy that I'm talking about. The early church believed that, you know, when Jesus said that you need to forgive people or he won't forgive you, they thought, you know what, we better really try to forgive people. You know, that was they when Jesus said that, you know, you could, I wrote this thing out to kind of encapsulate all the things that Jesus teaches. And I used like a spreadsheet and went through like the book of Matthew and a few other places. And so this is what I've got. Jesus did not teach once saved, always saved. He taught that salt could lose its savor and could be good for nothing but being thrown into the fire. He taught that seeds of faith can begin to grow in a person, but persecution, worldly living, or riches can cause them to fall away. He taught that people who can cast out demons and prophesy and heal will be rejected by him on judgment day because of their sinful behavior. He taught that if Christians who have fallen away don't repent and do the deeds that they first did, they will go to hell. He taught that names can be erased from the book of life. He taught that people who once had the fire of the Holy Spirit can quench that fire and go to hell. He taught that if you don't forgive others, he won't forgive you. And that if you deny him during persecution, he will deny you on judgment day. That you must endure to the end to be saved. He taught that if you don't use the gifts you've been given to be fruitful, you will go to hell. Unlike modern pastors, Jesus said that if you don't quit getting drunk, you'll go to hell. If you don't quit looking at women who are not your wife with lust, you will go to hell. If you marry a divorced woman or get remarried after a divorce while the other spouse is still living, you will go to hell. That if you don't control your anger, you'll go to hell. That if you judge others, he will use the same measure to judge you. That if you don't take up your cross, deny yourself, and follow him, you are not worthy of him. And that if you don't act on his words, your house will fall. So modern teachers will admit that Jesus doesn't preach their gospel. There's no explicit teaching of Jesus that teaches grace by faith and that there's nothing that you can do to lose your salvation once you initially get the Holy Spirit. In fact, it's completely different. Jesus seems to be radically against once saved, always saved. There's multiple parables whose main point seems to be if you don't continue in the faith, you will go to hell. And so they know this. And so the various teachers say different things to get out of it. But what's interesting about it is that you can show that the early church believed that Jesus did teach Christianity, that what he was teaching on the Sermon on the Mount was something that he expected you to do or you would go to hell. And we see it as legalistic because it's almost like we can't even hear that gospel anymore. We reject that gospel and demand something else. And what's interesting about this is we typically think that, you know, Paul preached something else, but I can show you, Paul preached all those things that I just said. Paul has an equal saying the same thing. The only difference is that Paul preached specifically on the justification by faith issue, which was in context almost exclusively about circumcision, but certainly about the works of the law and how that those works cannot be used to be justified. That was a major problem that he was dealing with in the first century, almost exclusively circumcision. You saw the council in Jerusalem was about that question. Do the Gentiles have to be circumcised to be saved? And so most of what Paul is talking about in the book of Romans and Galatians is specifically, I think he mentions the word circumcision like 50 times, It's clearly what he's talking about. So what changed? It was the Protestant Reformation. So we typically think of what Luther did in the Protestant Reformation as sort of a return back to the original Christianity. That's the way it's typically sold to us. But that is provably not true. And when you see the things that Luther invented, that everybody agrees Luther invented, it's the core of the ye shall not surely die message that infected Germany immediately after Luther, and then ultimately has infected the whole world with this idea that we can have our sin back. So what do I mean? So the works of the law issue, what Luther's contribution to this was, is to say, you know, I know it looked like Paul was, when talking about justification by faith, was really talking about just circumcision and the works of the law. But Luther's contribution was to say, you know, I think that works of the law really means anything, any obedience to Jesus at all. Like, obedience to Jesus is a work of the law to Luther. And that was his contribution. I think he says something like, anything that is not of faith is of works. So repentance from sin is a work. In fact, if you tried to be obedient to Jesus's commandments, that's a work. And now you're somehow a heretic. But as a result of this, and Luther is accredited with inventing what we call imputed righteousness, but what he called passive righteousness. But he talks about it, and there's some interesting quotes from Luther about, you know, coming up with it. And he actually comes up with it as a consequence of his study about indulgences, which is what the 95 Theses were all about, you know, well, not all about, but primarily about the way that they were teaching indulgences, which was a matter of like selling the saints and the Pope's righteousness. And so Luther was sort of dealing with an argument against the fact that the saints and the popes, you know, their righteousness isn't that great either. And he sort of happens upon this imputed righteousness thing. But it was really Calvin that sort of crystallized imputed righteousness and made it what it is today. And imputed righteousness gives you once saved, always saved. I mean, that's why essentially Calvin is credited with the first one to really do once saved, always saved. Luther himself did not do once. He did not take it that far, although he could have, because he developed the doctrines that led to once saved, always saved being an inevitable consequence. But absolutely no one before Calvin teached once saved, always saved. I wanted to do a project that had an opportunity to go into all this stuff. And not just like, and to get into it into granular detail, to get into how imputed righteousness, and then to answer the question, well, what then? I mean, how do we deal with, you know, sanctification and particularly the atonement? I think the atonement may be the most important thing in all this. Exactly how does Jesus's death save us from our sins, if not the sort of wrath satisfaction model developed by essentially Anselm and then later codified by Calvin. So what happened before that? What did people believe for the first like 1500 years about what happened? Because it certainly wasn't wrath satisfaction. You know, it's such an interesting thing about the Old Testament sacrifices, and how did they believe that those were, they didn't believe that Jesus or that God was satisfying his wrath on those lambs in order to see them through some lens of justification. Clearly, and Leviticus tells you straight up what the meaning of the reason for the sanctification was, is that life was in the blood, and that life needed to the cleansing was the reason you did sacrifices. You needed to have the blood because there was life in the blood. You sprayed the blood on everything. The blood had to be on the temple and on the altar and on the people, and everything had to be cleansed with the blood. That's what the blood does. It cleanses. It's not the act of him smashing it that satisfies his wrath. No, it's a cleansing. That's a point. And so we've gone from blood cleansing to God satisfying his wrath. And propitiation is sort of how they get there, which is a mistranslation. I mean, the word, if you look up in your Bible what the word propitiation means in the Greek, it means the lid of the Ark of the Covenant. That's all it means. Propitiation in English means the satisfying of God's wrath, but it just means the lid of the Ark of the Covenant in the Greek. And anyway, that's an extremely detailed thing that could take forever. It goes back to like, what is even Satan doing? And like, what is the purpose of like life? And what is the nature of this cosmic war? And what really matters and what does the Holy Spirit even do, and why is the Holy Spirit needed? Why did, you know, how does Jesus' death apply to the Holy Spirit? Why did he need to resurrect from the dead? I'm absolutely floored about the complete ignorance about the reason for the resurrection of the dead in terms of Jesus's case. Anyway, I've got so much to say. I just want to sort of give you a taste that there's almost like a year's worth of stuff here. Although I'm probably going to take my time because I want to actually release this as a podcast of individual episodes that are fully fledged. Like they can be a book, they can be a chapter in a book, but they're also going to be pieced together as a long movie at some point. So I want to fully do them as a movie, each part, and each part may be, I don't know, 30 minutes to an hour long. So we could be talking about 10 plus hours of stuff here. In one way, I think I owe it to you guys because most of my career has been, you know, teaching what I now believe to be a satanic deception. And I feel like though, you know, my sins are forgiven in that regard, I've got some, you know, redeeming of the time to do with that. And so if you'll be willing to hear me out on this, even if currently you're like, you know, I don't feel like you're going in the right direction, Chris, just listen to the arguments. I'm sure that I can at least make you believe that there are two good sides to the story. All right, that's it for me. I hope you guys are doing well. Remember to subscribe to the appropriate podcast feed, either Nowhere to Run with Chris White or Bible Prophecy Talk on your favorite podcatcher, as well as to the Once Saved, Always Saved, a documentary film channel on YouTube, as well as the Facebook page dedicated to the Once Saved, Always Saved film as well, where I will ultimately be releasing the videos, although I'll also be releasing them on the Nowhere to Run feed on this podcast. Okay, bye.